We think about healthy lungs, or even lungs that, if you've got asthma, if you're using the right medication, your lungs should stay open the whole way through the exercise. So therefore, if you're doing most forms of endurance exercise, so you're still going to breathe deep and you're still going to breathe hard, but it shouldn't feel that your breathing is the thing that's holding you back.
This is Running for Real, the podcast for runners who know that for every runner's high, there are just as many lows. All those just missed PRs, easy runs that feel hard, injury blues, and more. Each week, we'll talk to running, health, and wellness experts about their highs, lows, and best advice to build our confidence. Running for Real is about being honest, being brave, and most of all, not feeling alone. And now here's our host, Tina Muir.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode 148 of the Running for Real podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today. I truly appreciate you being here. These episodes are so important. This is the Beyond Running series. This is episode 6 of the Beyond Running series. So for those of you who don't know what Beyond Running is, we are doing an 8-week series where I'm covering topics that are often left unsaid, things that make people uncomfortable, things that we avoid because they are things that we don't really feel ready to confront. But maybe it's something you're working through. Maybe it's something someone you care about is working through. Maybe it's just a stranger, but if we all learn to kind of speak correctly about the way that we say these things, if we learn to understand how people are feeling, we're not going to make them feel worse. We're going to make them feel better. And I really think that is going to make a difference. So far we have covered anxiety disorder. We've covered visual impairments, suicide. We covered disabilities. We covered miscarriage last week. And then today we are covering asthma, particularly athletic asthma. And then next week we have menopause and we have one other episode after that. Now, as I said, maybe you are going through it. Maybe it's someone you know who is going through it. But either way, this is really important to listen to. And it's really important to share that we keep bringing awareness to these topics. I remember how bad I felt with the amenorrhea thing, that I felt like no one understood me. I felt like I was completely alone, and I hate the idea of people feeling that with other things. So if you can be brave enough to share about these, particularly if you are working through it or someone you know is, you never know who you might help. So I hope these episodes are something educational for you and maybe bringing you some comfort too. Now, today we have John Dickinson, who is a respiratory physiologist at the University of Kent. He's done all kinds of research, all kinds of studies on this topic. And I wanted to talk about athletic asthma because I have had a few of you talk to me about this over the years, about struggling through it. And breathing problems are pretty common, but you know, there's maybe a lot of things you're going to hear about in this episode that you didn't know about. I certainly did not. This was very eye-opening for me. And I think many people will understand this. If you don't know someone who has asthma, maybe it is you, but it can be quite difficult to work through. And I also asked John about the whole doping issue, or maybe not doping issue, but the kind of that gray area within elite sports of people using inhalers to potentially enhance their performance. I do ask John about this in the show, so a little bit controversial, but I was just curious for myself, and maybe you are too. Now, within these episodes, there are no sponsors, but if you do appreciate me or what I'm doing with these Beyond Running series, I would love if you could support me on Patreon. Whatever you can afford, whatever you can handle would be amazing. You can find that at patreon.com/runningforreal. Or if you haven't already left me an iTunes rating or review, that is amazing if you could do that. It really helps me get found. Thank you so much to everyone who already has. I appreciate that so much. All right, there's lots of links in the show notes, and be sure to listen. You don't have to pay too much attention with where John is talking about going to. I will have all the links in the show notes. And if you want me to email the show notes to you every time a new episode comes out, send me an email, tina@tinamuir.com, and I will make sure I do that every week for you. All right, let's go meet John. John, thank you so much for joining me on the Running for Real podcast. I really appreciate you giving me this time. As I said to you before we started this recording, you are a very busy man, and I am thankful that you are here. So thank you for joining me.
So it's a pleasure to speak to you.
Yeah, this is going to be great. And, you know, this is kind of a topic out of these Beyond Running episodes that people might be a bit like, huh? Like, this doesn't seem like something that is brushed under the carpet or something that is kind of ignored. People, you know, quite confidently say they have asthma. It's not something that people are embarrassed about. But the reason I wanted to get this as an episode is because I have heard, you know, friends saying that they struggle with asthma, particularly during exercise. We all would imagine know someone who has asthma, but when it comes to exercise, a lot of the time it is kind of given a bit of a bad rap, like, oh, you're just out of shape. That's why you can't breathe. You need to get fitter. So I'd love for you to explain, like, what is asthma? What are the different variations of it? And why is it about more than just kind of being out of shape and that's why you can't breathe?
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, we could spend 40 minutes just talking about what asthma is, but I'll try and okay. summarize it quickly for you. So asthma is basically a term that's used for a condition that's what we call an obstructive airway disease. And so what that means is it means that when an individual experiences asthma, their airways in their lungs, they narrow when they breathe out. So that just means that the flow of air out of their lungs is reduced. And so therefore they can't breathe as much air out as fast. Mm. What triggers it off can differ between different people. So some people are asthmatic to dogs and cats. Some people are asthmatic to pollution. Some people get asthma when they're in a dusty environment. Sometimes it's a dry environment. It's not the same for every person. So somebody might have asthma and if they have a cat, they get rid of the cat, the asthma goes away. Mm. Other people, it might be they only have asthma when they exercise. And what basically asthma is, it's driven by, as you're breathing in air, some particulates will get into your lower airways and they will trigger off an inflammatory response. And the inflammatory response then triggers off a muscle constriction around the airway. And so therefore, an individual can't breathe out very well. Now, that obstruction isn't chronic, so it only happens in the presence of the trigger.
So it's like an allergy, essentially. Like it is, you're allergic, you could be allergic to pollution or cats or anything.
Yes, so it's almost like an overreaction to the trigger. And, okay. And so everybody who experiences being in pollution will have an inflammatory response, but individuals with asthma might have a sort of hypersecrete the inflammation, so therefore they're more likely to experience asthma in that environment. Mm. Now, when an individual starts to use medication for their asthma, the medication is targeted at two things. One is to act against the inflammation, and that's an inhaler, usually in inhaler form. It's called a corticosteroid, and you take that every day, and that reduces the inflammation inside an individual's lungs. And then you might see individuals using a blue inhaler, like called salbutamol, or in America it's called albuterol. Mm-hmm. And that inhaler works, is primarily there to relax the muscle around the airway. And it works within sort of a minute or so, and it lasts for about 4 hours. So the idea is that an individual with asthma would use their anti-inflammatory inhaler, which is usually a corticosteroid, every day, and then just use their emergency inhaler when they feel that they're getting a little bit sort of tight-chested, or they're starting to feel the symptoms of asthma. Okay. The symptoms of asthma could be cough, could be wheeze when you breathe out, could be just feeling tight-chested, could just be difficulty in breathing, you also produce quite a lot of mucus, and that mucus is sort of the byproduct of the inflammation, and it's the lungs' way of getting rid of the inflammation from the airways.
Mm. And how does exercise come into this? I mean, obviously, the tightening of the airway is going to make it difficult to exercise because you are breathing faster and heavier. But how does exercise affect anyone with asthma? Is it kind of case by case?
It is case by case, but exercise is probably one of the main triggers for asthma. Mm-hmm. So it's estimated around about 90% of people with asthma have their asthma triggered off by exercise. And it can also be the case that exercise could be the only trigger. So we see some individuals that don't have asthma in other situations, but when they exercise, they develop an asthma.
How would that be the case?
So if you think about when you're at rest, most of the air you're breathing is through your nose. So the air gets nicely warm and humidified, and the amount of air you're breathing isn't a massive amount. It's probably breathing somewhere between 3 to 6 liters, depending on the size of the person that at rest. When you start exercising, the amount of air you're breathing per minute increases. And at a given load of exercise, usually just after a light jog, most people are going to switch from being a nose breather to a mouth breather. And what that does, it means that the air that you're breathing in isn't filtered back through your nose. So it's not warmed, it's not humidified, and it's not filtered in your upper airway. All of this, so you're breathing more air, and this air also isn't being filtered. So it's going into your lower airways unfiltered. And that means there's potentially more allergens in it. The air is also drier when it enters your lower airway. And so therefore, the lower airway has to do a lot of warming and humidifying of the air. And that warming and humidifying of the air can almost cause a dehydration response to the lining of your lungs. And then that causes an inflammatory process to protect the lungs. And in individuals that are susceptible to that, that causes the muscles to constrict. So it's in its most basic form, exercise-induced asthma is caused by an increasing amount of air that you're breathing, and it basically drying out the airway. That causes an inflammatory process, which then causes the muscle constriction. What you tend to find, though, is the actual, unless you've got quite severe asthma, the actual obstruction doesn't actually occur until after you finish the exercise. So exercise itself can actually help keep the airway open because it actually dilates the airway. But as soon as you stop it, that's when most people probably feel the worst. It's probably within about 5 minutes of stop, 5 to 10 minutes within stopping of exercise.
So would most people see it as, maybe people listening haven't realised that's the case, or maybe seen it as, oh, I just pushed myself really hard and now I'm breathing really hard.
Yeah. And so we find a lot, I mean, I do a lot of work with sort of high-level athletes, and a lot of these high-level athletes actually don't even recognise they've got a form of asthma. So when we do our test to actually try and see if we might screen a group of athletes for asthma, and they'll do our test where we sort of ask them to breathe like they would do when they're exercising. They finish that piece of breathing for us and they say, oh, it just feels like I've done a training session. And they might have a little bit of a cough, and then we measure their lung function, and their lung function's dropped by 30%. And they go, oh, I just thought this is what it should feel like after you've done some hard work. It should feel a bit tight-chested. It should feel like you have a little bit of a cough because I've just pushed my body really hard, and that's what happens. And sometimes that sort of feeling a tight chest and having a sort of persistent cough after exercise might actually be sort of some sort of mild asthmatic response to doing the exercise. So we do find a lot of athletes can get by and get through the exercise, but actually after they finish the exercise is when they experience the issue.
So where do you draw the line there between, like, I would imagine most people, okay, coming to mind for me, I've had plenty of workouts where I finished with a cough, like because I pushed myself, or races, and yeah, I've been kind of coughing the rest of the day. But coming to mind for me is running on an indoor track. Like every time without fail, after a hard workout or race, I would be struggling to breathe and have a cough. But how much of that is that's very dry air inside a track? Like, how would you know if someone, I'm just thinking for someone listening, like, when does it become a case of everyone has asthma because they're all running on an indoor track and everyone is coughing versus, actually like it being a problem here?
Yeah. I mean, this is the problem with simply using symptoms to almost diagnose an asthmatic issue. Because if you think about the main symptoms of asthma, they're coughing, wheezing, tight chest, and maybe a bit of excess mucus. Now, if you open up a sort of a medical textbook and you look at the different conditions, the respiratory diseases and cardiovascular diseases that you can have, those symptoms will maybe be relevant for opening up probably over 100 different types of issues. So that they're non-specific to asthma. So asthmatics might experience them, but just because you're coughing after exercise doesn't mean it's definitely asthma.
Okay.
Just because you get it in a dry environment doesn't mean it's asthma. It might purely be that it's your upper airway that's just dried out and that's what develops the cough.
I see.
So whenever we work with individuals that might be suspected to have asthma, then you have to do what we call an objective test. And so therefore we want to do an objective test to actually look at an individual's lung function and then basically get them to demonstrate they have asthma by either demonstrating that if they take the inhaler, their lung function improves, or if they do some form of exercise, their lung function drops off. And by then we can objectify that, yes, you have some form of asthma and you're going to benefit from the inhalers. And so that's probably why I'm in business in terms of working with athletes. Because basically, before I start, well, maybe 20, 25 years ago, you know, doctors would be quite willing to sort of go, well, those symptoms sound like asthma, have an inhaler.
Yeah.
And what we've found since the sort of systematically testing the athletes is if doctors do that, they get the diagnosis wrong 50% of the time.
Huh, interesting.
Then they may as well flip a coin. If you're going to a doctor complaining of symptoms and they don't do any tests, they may as well flip a coin to decide the diagnosis.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to talk about what people can do if they do think they need to be tested to see what is going on. But you mentioned a few times working with high-level athletes. You know, you've worked with the Olympic teams. Tell us about how you were involved with that, because many people would have thought, oh, I thought it was just kind of recreational runners, but I didn't realize elite or even Olympic athletes would be struggling with asthma.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been working with the sort of British Olympic teams and the elite athletes in the UK ever since 2003. Mm-hmm. Initially, I started as a PhD student working with this. And the reason why I initially started working with it was because the 2004 Summer Olympic Games were the first Summer Olympic Games where if athletes were using the salbutamol, the emergency inhalers, you had to prove they had evidence of asthma to be able to use the medication. And so that meant that previously athletes didn't need to be sort of objectively tested, and they needed someone to come in and do the objective tests. And that's sort of where my work started with this.
Can I just pause you a second? Yeah. How would someone like who was a very good runner get to the point where they could be at that high level if breathing was an issue? Like if they had asthma, wouldn't that kind of, before they got an inhaler, wouldn't that automatically kind of knock them down a few levels? Like how do they get past that kind of breathing issue to be good?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen there's different ways. I mean, for some, like we talked about before, the actual symptoms, the actual asthma might not happen until like they've actually finished their piece of exercise. So it might happen after they finish, so they can still get through the hard training. And then it's after they finish the hard training. And if they don't then have to train for maybe 5 or 6 hours, they've got enough time to recover before they train again. There are also, I mean, some of these guys might only have what we say mild asthma. So, you know, there might be a small drop, but it's not enough to really impact their sort of sport. Mm-hmm. So it is possible. I mean, I've tested Olympic champions who, when we actually perform our tests, I'll have maybe moderate asthma, but they haven't realized. And they've actually got all the way to the very top without actually realizing they've got some sort of mild asthma. But when you actually ask them what they do, they've sort of modified their training to sort of allow them to do their sport, but without and sort of accept they're going to get the symptoms they were experiencing are part of training. And then they modify their training to sort of cope with it, if that makes sense. And we always say that, okay, that's great, you've got that far. But actually, if we can actually open your airway, you know, if we actually stop you having the asthma by using the right inhalers, they're going to, well, one, their airway health, just their general health should improve. We know that if you have some form of asthma, you're maybe more susceptible to picking up cough, colds, chest infections. And so there might have been a bit of luck in there, but also if we can make sure they're on the right inhalers, then we can reduce their risk of getting chest infections. And probably, as you know, that you're ill, you can't train, and then that's going to impact performance as well. So it's not impossible. And it also might be, there is evidence to suggest that actually when they started doing the sport, they didn't have any form of asthma, and actually taking part in that sport and subjecting their lungs to such high ventilation rates over a prolonged period of time, they've actually developed mild asthma as they've sort of been training the sport. And that's the same way of viewing it, is people who live in polluted environments or people who work in polluted environments are more likely to have respiratory diseases than people that don't, because there's more triggers there. So they might have gone into that job without asthma, but actually working in that job for 10 years, they suddenly developed an asthmatic response to that environment. And it might be that, for example, sports like that take place in dry environments or cold environments or have a high ventilation requirement, you actually might develop a sort of a mild form of exercise induced asthma just from doing that sport for a prolonged period of time. It's probably not so much of a risk for people who are just training 3 or 4 times a week for an hour or so. It's probably more for your elite level athlete that's training maybe sort of 2, 3, 4 hours a day at high ventilation rates, and then throw in a dry environment or throw in polluted environment, and then they're at a higher risk. So so elite sport, it's, you know, and elite sport, you know, you probably know, you know, you probably pick up, in, you know, you pick up wear and tear injuries in your joints from pounding the streets. But it's the same thing with your lungs. Your lungs aren't not susceptible to airway damage, to damage from sort of high ventilation rates.
Mm.
And so you can develop it sort of as you go through.
Interesting. And so what's coming to mind to me when you were talking about that was Galen Rupp is definitely someone I know or I remember who has asthma. And I remember seeing pictures of him, you know, on cold days, putting on the mask to kind of warm his air. But I thought there was a bit of a controversy with that a few years ago, because most of that group of the Nike Oregon Project were on an inhaler. Is there any, you know, obviously if they need it, they need it. But are there any performance aspects that come from taking an inhaler if you didn't need it?
Okay, we're going into grey zone here.
Dangerous.
I've done quite a bit of sort of research in it. I get asked that quite a lot, especially by athletes who were either testing or even the ones that were saying actually maybe you didn't realise you have asthma, but actually you do. And you know, sometimes they're quite cautious about starting inhalers, which because they don't want to sort of fall into that. Be deemed as, oh, what, you got an inhaler now, have you? Oh, all right, okay. You know, that might make you run faster now, mightn't it?
Mm-hmm.
The research that we've been involved in basically demonstrates that if you're from just using therapeutic doses of the inhalers, there's no indication that therapeutic doses improve endurance performance or strength and power performance. Now, the asthma medications are regulated by the World Anti-Doping Agency. And so stronger doses of those types of drugs potentially can have improvements in performance. However, the anti-doping code is designed to try and stop athletes accessing the higher doses. So from a medical point of view, if athletes want to take doses that are likely to be performance enhancing, they're likely to be in a very bad state in terms of their respiratory health.
Mm.
For example, the emergency inhalers, they're called beta 2 agonists. Now, there's a long list of beta 2 agonists, and athletes aren't allowed to take most of them. They're only allowed to take for asthma purposes inhaled salbutamol, which is the rescue inhaler, and they're only allowed to take up to 8 inhalations of it in one go, so 800 micrograms of salbutamol in a 12-hour period.
Because what if you, like, how could you regulate someone doing that?
Well, so if they go above the 800, there's a chance that there's a cutoff in the urine. So when someone does a doping test, they're analysing for salbutamol.
Mm.
And if they take more than 800, the concentration of salbutamol in the urine will likely go above the threshold that WADA are looking for. And if it goes above that, that would probably indicate they're taking too much salbutamol in that time period. Now, the reason why that's there is because there is some evidence if you take a large dose of beta 2 agonists, it can improve your strength and power performance.
Mm.
But the side effects from doing it, you know, you think about beta 2 agonists, it's basically a refined form of adrenaline. So you get shakes, you get heart palpitations, you get a lot of side effects. And so probably the side effects are probably going to offset any performance gain you get.
Okay.
And in my mind, there's way better ways to cheat than get going nuts on asthma medication.
Okay.
So as long as an athlete's using therapeutic doses like they're supposed to be from a doctor, one, they shouldn't be at risk of an anti-doping violation, and two, it's only going to make their lungs sort of as good as they would be if they didn't have asthma. It doesn't give you super lungs.
Okay.
So it doesn't open up your airways and make you be able to breathe so much better.
Yeah.
It only allows you your airways to sort of open up.
Okay.
On the other side, there is a bit of a gray zone with the corticosteroids. So again, with inhaled corticosteroids, there's no evidence that it improves performance. But there is a sort of a loophole in the system where athletes, if they say that their asthma is really uncontrolled, they can apply to get therapeutic use exemption and use some of the stronger corticosteroids that you would probably give to an individual that is either in hospital because of their asthma or they're on the verge of going to hospital because of their asthma. So instead of taking the inhaled corticosteroids, they take it in pill form, and that's much stronger, has an anti-inflammatory effect around the whole body.
I see.
And then that's going to impact on things like inflammatory processes, going to impact on your perception of how hard you're working. And so potentially athletes who get granted that, there's a potential for them to receive a performance enhancing effect. But again, if an athlete is using that stronger drug for the reason that their lung health is deteriorated to a point where they need it, they're probably not in a fit state to actually compete on a high level anyway.
Okay.
In my view, if they need it, they probably shouldn't be competing, because from a health point of view.
Okay.
But the way the rules are made up at the minute, there is scope for
abuse.
Yeah. Mm. You know, you get a sort of a medic who's willing to look at the rules and go, well, you know, you've got asthma. It's not very well controlled, is it? So let's put some evidence together that allows you to use the prednisolone during a competition. Then, I've not come across evidence for happening, but it's just the way the rules are made up.
Mm.
There is some gray zone to it.
Okay, interesting. Thank you for explaining that. All right, so we've just been talking about inhalers, finding the right dose. For someone who is listening, is it just a case of you getting an inhaler? Like, here's an inhaler, now it's going to be okay? Do you have to kind of play around with dosages? Is there going to be kind of a bit of a transition time for someone who has been diagnosed with asthma while they figure out what that dosage is? How does that work?
Yeah, so basically there are sort of guidance for sort of prescribing asthma medications, and it's basically on a sort of a stepwise sort of tiered system. So hopefully part of the diagnosis involves some objective test. So the doctor should have an idea of how severe the individual's asthma is. And so from that, they'll prescribe medication that might be sort of stepping in at step one, or if they think it's quite severe, they might go in at step three, for example. And there's different medications, but what should happen is that everybody who has an asthma diagnosis should be prescribed what's called a prevention inhaler, so the inhaled corticosteroid inhaler, and that should be used on a daily basis, regardless of whether you're training or not, because what that does is it dampens down the inflammatory process inside of the lung. Now, that medication takes around about 2 weeks to build up into your system. So a lot of people might receive a sort of, they're sort of brown or purple in sort of appearance. And these inhalers, and they might feel that I take my brown inhaler and it doesn't do anything because it takes 2 weeks to build up into your system. And so compare that to a blue inhaler like the salbutamol or the albuterol that works within a minute or so. They sometimes feel the salbutamol works, the corticosteroid doesn't work, so I won't use the corticosteroid, I'll just use the blue inhaler.
Mm-hmm.
But that's got consequences over time, because what you're not doing is dealing with the cause of the issue. And so what we know is if individuals commit to just getting through training sessions using salbutamol, then they're not dealing with the inflammatory process. And what it does is it puts your lungs at a higher risk of airway damage. So you're more likely to have more inflammation. And also, if you solely rely on salbutamol to get through a session, then your body builds up a resistance to the salbutamol, and you might need more of it to get through. And that might mean that when you're actually in a real bad situation, you need more and more salbutamol to get through the session. So it's really important that people who have a diagnosis of asthma, they use their prevention inhaler. And then that means that they don't have to use their rescue inhaler, so like the salbutamol or the albuterol, as often as possible. And so that's the best way to get on inhalers, is find a prevention inhaler that basically most of the time keeps you symptom free.
Mm-hmm.
And then you barely need to use your salbutamol inhaler.
Oh, okay.
And that's the goal. Ideally, what you need to do is work very closely with asthma nurses, and respiratory consultants to find the inhalers that work for you. Because there are lots of different options, and some work better with some people, and some work, and it's difficult to tell until you're sort of giving it a go.
Okay.
But it's really important to encourage your medical practitioner to do objective tests so that they're confident, because what you don't want to do is just sort of use inhalers in the dark.
Okay.
Because if you do that, you might start over-treating your asthma. And we see a lot of individuals that have asthma, but then they also have another issue. My phone going again. So therefore, it might be that you're basically over-treating the asthma and you're missing something else. And okay. We see a lot of athletes have asthma and 90% of them have another respiratory issue as well. Sometimes that's in the nose. Sometimes it's in the upper airway, in the throat. Sometimes it's mechanically how they're actually trying to get the air into their lungs.
So yeah, let's talk about that, because you mentioned that to me before the interview started, that you know, people might have asthma symptoms, but it may be another breathing issue going on. Now, I would imagine most people listening have had some kind of issue with their breathing at some point. So tell us about some of the other things that could be going on here that maybe if someone is having persistent breathing problems, they should get checked out.
Yeah. So a lot of these other issues are actually more prevalent during the run, during your running, rather than sort of after you finish. Mm-hmm. So I see a lot of individuals that have come to me. They might have a diagnosis of asthma, they might not, and they'll be reporting when I do. It might be intermittent high intensity efforts, or it might be when I go running uphill, or just when I start running, I start to feel tight chest. I start to feel like I can't get a satisfying breath in. I start to feel that my throat starts to close up. And some of them might report wheezing when they're breathing in. But then as soon as they stop running, within sort of 5 minutes, the symptoms are gone.
See, how do you determine between that and just, you're just running, you know, you're just exercising?
Yeah. Well, you should feel, if your airways are open, that's whether if you've got asthma or not. So if you're on the right inhalers, your airway should be open. And if you haven't got asthma, your airway should be open. Now, in most scenarios, the way our lungs work, they should be able to cope with most forms of endurance exercise. So therefore, you should be able to run without feeling that your breathing is the thing that's sort of holding you back. So the reason why individuals might feel that their breathing is limited. So if we think about healthy lungs, or even lungs that if you've got asthma, if you're using the right medication, your lungs should stay open the whole way through the exercise. So therefore, if you're doing most forms of endurance exercise, you shouldn't feel that it's sort of your breathing that is the limiting factor for what you're doing. So you're still going to breathe deep and you're still going to breathe hard, but it shouldn't feel that your breathing is the thing that's holding you back.
Even like something going up a hill, like you mentioned that,
even when you're working at the very, very top, it shouldn't be. I mean, you're going to be breathing deep and hard and fast, but it shouldn't be that's holding you back. If it is, then it's likely to be something to do with the way you're breathing. So we see a lot of individuals don't sort of move their rib cage effectively. So we see a lot of individuals that report those sort of symptoms that they breathe using almost sort of breathe up with sort of a lot of shoulder activation, a lot of tension through their neck.
That's me, 100%.
Okay. And when you actually analyze their breathing pattern, if you think about where your rib cage should move, it needs to go sideways, forwards, and up. Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you actually analyze these people's breathing patterns, you see their rib cage is going forwards and up, but it's not coming sideways. Mm. So therefore, if your rib cage isn't moving effectively, then you're not actually allowing your lungs to fill up effectively for what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
And so therefore, you get that sort of sensation. I'm not getting quite as much air as I want to. And then the consequence of that is breathing a bit faster and a bit faster and a bit faster. And you suddenly start to get away. So you can get away. I call it naughty breathing. You can get away with naughty breathing for a while. Mm-hmm. And then it suddenly comes to be that feeling that I can't go any hard. I can't go any faster because my breathing is so fast. And then you suddenly, a lot of the side effects of people who breathe like that is they get very tight traps. So they get tight sort of shoulders, have sore backs. And because they're holding themselves so stiff when they're trying to run fast. And so we see individuals that might have that sort of, we call it apical breathing. So they're sort of very shouldery with their breath and sort of breathing very high up. We also see another group of individuals that where their lower ribcage movement isn't synced up with their upper ribcage movement. So they sort of, we call it breathing asynchronously. So if you actually watch their chest move, that sort of their abdomen and their lower chest moves first. And then their upper chest moves second, then it's sort of a two-phase breath. Okay. And again, that has an impact on the movement mechanics of the rib cage and doesn't allow as much air into your lungs as you'd like. And so the consequence of both of those two breathing patterns are a smaller breath. And then because you're doing smaller breath, you have to breathe faster. Mm-hmm. And then because you're breathing in maybe a way that's using what we call accessory respiratory muscles. So like you're using more shoulders to move. They cost more energy to move. So you're putting more energy into your breathing. And also the feedback that your respiratory system's giving centrally then starts to tell your brain, for this level of work, we are working really hard. And so messages then get sent around the rest of the body to the other systems to say, respiratory muscles are going nuts. We need to slow you down because you can't continue to work like this. And the body will start to protect its sort of main organs. So it will base. So there is evidence to show that if your respiratory muscles are working too hard, then your blood flow to maybe your working muscles gets reduced. Oh. So therefore it slows you down. So a lot of these people might report, I feel really heavy legged. I mean, I feel tight chest, then my legs are just dead.
And should have met you 10 years ago. Man. I'm just saying to everyone listening who's like, oh, shut up, Tina, trying to like jump on the back. I said to you most of those things before we even started recording this episode. that I have experienced that when running. Well, this is annoying, but anyway, thank you for explaining this. This is so, okay. So, what should those people do? I'm too far gone at this point. I've gone over the hill. But for someone listening who is struggling with what you just said right there, what do they need to do if it's not asthma?
Well, I mean, I've sort of developed techniques to help individuals sort of improve their breathing pattern. Things that they can do initially would be to actually get someone to observe their breathing pattern. So if they go for a run, it's quite hard to look at the way you're breathing when you're running. But if they go for a run and then stop, you can get somebody to look at your breathing pattern and look at the movement of someone's rib cage. It should ideally be moving sideways, forwards and up in one big smooth movement. If you're seeing an individual that's reporting tight chest and their shoulders are just shooting up, or the movement of the lower rib cage and upper rib cage is out of sync, that might suggest actually we can do some work there. And then it's a case of becoming aware of it to start with. And then, I mean, I work really closely with individuals and actually help them retrain their breathing. So it might be a case of getting in touch with a respiratory physiotherapist, or sometimes speech therapists can be really helpful.
Do you know what the equivalent would be in the US or maybe Australia, if you know too, but just because physiotherapists, that doesn't really exist in the US. So what kind of person would someone see here in the US, as most of my listeners are US?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, there's not many therapists that are specialized in dealing with breathing problems in athletes. So a lot of these guys might have a breathing problem at rest. It might only be during exercise when they start to develop this breathing issue. So from my experience, there's not loads of people around the world that are really experienced in managing it. But, someone like an athletic trainer with a specialist issue in breathing issues might be helpful. Okay. Speech and language therapists, I don't know if...
Yeah, there's speech therapists. Yeah, definitely. Yep. Those are quite commonly available. Okay.
Sometimes the speech therapist, though, most of their exercises are aimed at breathing during rest. And they'll be trying to focus through breathing through the nose and out through the mouth, which help with the basics. Obviously, you're going to breathe slightly differently when you're running, but they may be able to help with just getting that individual thinking about where they're breathing from.
Okay.
And thinking about actually that smooth, sideways, lateral, smooth movement through that whole of that breath is what people are trying to achieve.
Okay.
And what I find is it's really easy to point it out. It's quite difficult for people to change their breathing pattern. Because they, it's a little bit like someone to hold a fork differently. You know, you've been holding the fork a certain way so long, and then someone says, no, I want you to hold your finger slightly differently, and it feels horrible. And so trying to get people to change their breathing pattern initially can be quite difficult, especially during high-intensity exercise. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people, most people I work with probably take about 4 to 6 weeks to change their breathing pattern.
Yeah.
But it has taken me with some individuals maybe over a year to fix.
Okay.
And there are issues that are linked to this as well. So you might find individuals, and we've probably all come across them, people who run and make this really loud noise when they breathe in. It's sort of...
That's me.
Yeah. So that noise is sometimes caused by a poor breathing pattern, but the actual noise itself is coming from the larynx. And it's a condition that's... I work with a really good team of... respiratory consultants in the UK, and there's also some really good guys in Norway and in Copenhagen that look at this, and there are some guys in America as well. And that condition is called exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction. And basically, it's that the larynx sits on top of your windpipe, and it should stay out of the way during exercise. But individuals that have this laryngeal obstruction, it sort of folds over the top of your windpipe, And so therefore the gap that the air's got to go through at the top of your windpipe is smaller.
Mm.
So it generates that noise, and also it can disturb the flow of air into your lungs.
Mm.
And a lot of these people sort of finish the run and have this really sort of burning, dry throat with a sort of persistent cough. So people that have that, breathing pattern exercise work is really helpful, and in a large number of cases gets rid of the laryngeal obstruction. But there are cases where sometimes it doesn't matter how good you make the breathing pattern, that you have to do a little bit of surgery on that area, and that can get rid of it as well.
But I take it to do that, you would need to be, like, most people wouldn't want to go to that extreme just to be able to rub it. That kind of surgery you're talking about, like Olympians who, you know.
I mean, basically what would happen, I mean, the guys in the UK see recreational sort of exercises as well as elites. But generally speaking, the sort of the surgery is the last resort.
Yeah.
Okay, you've got that. Let's go get some surgery. Mm-hmm. Because say most of the time, if you can correct the breathing pattern, the laryngeal obstruction goes away.
Mm, okay.
And most of the time, the individuals either see me or they see one of the respiratory specialists, one of the respiratory therapists in the hospital, and their issues work through and it's fine.
Mm,
and
they don't have
surgery. But we have had, there's been, I say, probably 5 to 10% of the cases where they have had to go for surgery, and then it's resolved, and people we work with have gone from being good to being very good, because they can suddenly then complete all their high intensity training efforts they're trying to do, and then they get the benefits of just being able to do that hard work. And they say they come on, and we see it a lot of the time in sort of individuals between the age of 16 to 22.
Okay.
As they're starting to increase their intensity.
Yeah.
And they're trying to become a bit better. We see it in individuals that may be a little bit anxious.
Mm.
So a lot of individuals that have a little bit sort of high anxiety levels, sometimes trying to over control their breathing when they're running, sometimes get it. And so it can be, it's not just a physical thing or mechanical thing. Sometimes it's a little bit of a stress related issue as well.
Okay, interesting. All right, so let's talk about loved ones. So someone listening who maybe someone in their life who is important to them is kind of working through some kind of asthma, some kind of breathing issue. They're trying to get it sorted out, but they're really frustrated. They're considering not doing it at all. They want to quit, but they don't want to quit. And the loved one's having a hard time, like, just make up your mind, like, this is causing you so much heartbreak. Like, why do you want to keep doing this? What would you say in advice to someone who is a loved one listening, who is their loved one is dealing with some kind of breathing issue?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think supporting them, the first thing, I'd be encouraging them, if someone's really struggling with their breathing, I think the first thing is to probably try and encourage them to work with their medical practitioner, basically, to try and get to the bottom of it. Now, it might be to encourage them to do some proper asthma tests to make sure it's asthma that's causing the issue. If it's that and that's controlled, then it's a case of actually encouraging them to not become solely reliant on the asthma if they're still symptomatic on top of the asthma. So we see a lot of individuals, as soon as they get that diagnosis of asthma, they get, right, every time I've got a breathing problem, it's asthma.
Yeah.
And so they start reaching for the inhaler every time they're short of breath. And it's about trying to work with the person with the asthma to try and make them understand what is their asthmatic issue and what may be breathing issues that aren't directly related to the asthma. And it's about encouraging them, because if someone with asthma is using the right medication, they should be able to basically train symptom free.
Okay.
So we can get there, and it's about being positive. I mean, what we actually see is people with asthma and the well controlled actually can outperform their non-asthmatic counterparts.
Hmm.
So it shouldn't be seen as a sort of a limitation, as long as it's being cared for properly. So I say individuals that are really struggling with their breathing during sport really need that support to sort of go, okay, you know, because it can be really distressing.
Mm-hmm.
If, you know, and I see a lot of individuals who get, you know, all very, very depressed in terms of, and I'm trying to do this. I really want to complete these five K runs or 10K runs, and I really want to do it in a certain time. But every time I get on the start line, I start running, and my breathing is really, really, really distressed. Mm-hmm. And it is distressing. It's distressing for the family as well. And I think everyone needs to know what the issue is, instead of what happens maybe out of the elite level is when you're working in maybe just working with your GP. Sometimes it's just the case of, we'll take the inhaler and get on with it. And you need to try and keep that conversation open with them to sort of let them know what you're doing, because ultimately we don't want people giving up because they're breathless. And we want people to enjoy exercise, and we want them to enjoy it without feeling that they're going to get breathless when they exercise. Mm-hmm. And so don't feel that that it's a closed door to the GP. Now they've said, like, you've got asthma, get on with it. Think about engaging with the practice. There might be asthma nurses that can help, that maybe you don't have to see the doctor that much. And make sure that they're confident that the asthma is well controlled. If the asthma is well controlled, then start to think about these extra things we talked about. Is it the way you're breathing? Because we see some people have maybe upper airway issues as well. That might not be the larynx that we talked about. It could be a nasal block. And they also need to address the what's going on in the nose as well and things. So it's about being supportive. And I think it's about encouraging that conversation to stay open with the medical team that's made the diagnosis in the first place.
Okay. All right. Thank you. And then, John, just to wrap up, maybe some resources that you recommend having good information, maybe to follow in the future to kind of learn more and kind of keep up to date with what they're doing research wise.
Yeah. In the UK, we've got, there's the Asthma UK charity that's got a load of information about asthma, about how to exercise, how to manage your asthma during exercise and things. And they got some really good tips on there. And that, it's Asthma UK, just type into a Google engine and you'll probably find that out. Mm-hmm. If people want to look at my web pages on my University of Kent account, there's some links to some of the papers we published. There's also, I've made some, presentations about about the tests that we do and that can help, answer questions about whether it's asthma or whether it's a different breathing issue. So they can find out a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. And then if they're interested about like exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction, there is a website that sort of explains exactly everything about that. And my colleague, Dr. James Hall at the Royal Brompton Hospital, he's got quite a nice website that explains all about exercise-induced laryngeal obstruction.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you so much for your time, for explaining this to us, and just, you know, doing your part to help people feel better, because, you know, it can be absolutely crushing when you are trying to work through this. So thank you for all that you do. And where can people find you in the future?
I'm at the University of Kent. So if they just type Dr. John Dickinson, University of Kent, I'm pretty sure they'd find me pretty quickly on my web pages. I also run a clinic in Harley Street at the Centre of Health and Human Performance. So if people are wanting to find out a little bit more about how their lungs are working and if they have any dysfunctional breathing pattern, they can contact me. My email is on the university web pages, or they can get in touch through the Harley Street Clinic so they can see it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you.
It's all right. Pleasure to chat.
My friends, if you have a minute and you could leave a review on your favorite podcast player, Apple Podcasts, aka iTunes, Stitcher, Overcast, Pocket Cast, Spotify, or whatever else podcast player you use to listen to this podcast, or if you would subscribe to this podcast, you will help me get out in front of new runners to make our tribe even bigger and even better. It might not seem like you as one person can make a difference, but really, it helps a lot. And it shows me you appreciate the hard work I put in for those. Thank you so much. Really eye-opening. I actually definitely going to make sure that I go see John if I decide to make a round two of my elite running career, because I think I have some issues that I have been ignoring for many years, just thinking that was part of running. And maybe there was a reason people were staring at me as I ran past them hyperventilating. But anyway, that's enough about me. I hope that episode was comforting and maybe not enjoyable. Maybe it was enjoyable. It was a great conversation with John. But if you are going through something with athletic asthma and you are struggling with your breathing, it's not exactly the most fun thing in the world. But I hope that brought you some comfort. And I hope that educated you if you are someone who just enjoys learning and wants to, you know, be better around the people that you care about. There's lots of links in the show notes if you need them, things that John has recommended. There's John's website that he mentioned that you can find out more about the studies he's been doing. And he's just a great person to follow in on Twitter for what he shares. So I would definitely recommend following him there. Now, if you wouldn't mind supporting me on Patreon, if you appreciate these episodes, I would be thankful for that. You can find that at patreon.com/runningforreal. That's patreon.com/runningforreal with the number 4. Or if not, if you could leave me an iTunes review, that would be amazing too. Thank you so much. Now, next week, as I said, we are going to be covering menopause with Dr. Stacey Sims. That is going to be episode 7 of our Beyond Running series. So I hope you will tune in for that one next Monday. On Friday, we have the one and only Dean Karnazes. So if you're not already subscribed to this podcast, go do it now.
Thanks for listening to the Running for Real podcast. Be sure to check out tinamuir.com for show notes and even more helpful running information.